This is David Zaslav. Welcome to Voices and Views V2.0 on KGPR 89.9 FM on your radio dial. And today, it's my great pleasure and privilege to welcome to the studio former mayor of Great Falls and head of the McLaughlin Institute's board, Randy Gray. Randy, welcome.
David, it's great to join you here today. Thanks for having me.
Randy, start out by telling our listeners how and when you actually came to be the mayor of Great Falls and when?
Well, in a moment of mental weakness, I decided that it would be very interesting to serve on the city commission. So I was a practicing lawyer in those days. I'm retired now. But in 1995, I first ran for the city commission just as a commissioner slot. It's a four-year slot. And I was fortunate enough to be elected for that four-year slot. I enjoyed it so much that I then ran for mayor three successive times and was elected as mayor. The mayor position in Great Falls is a two-year term. So I served three consecutive three-year terms, 6 years total as mayor, 4 years as a city commissioner. So a total of 10 years on the city commission of Great Falls.
Wow. And what do you remember most fondly about the Great Falls from that time when you were mayor? And tell us also what's changed the most for the better.
Well, I'll give you a warts and all. personally and selfishly, it's a fascinating position to serve in. If you have any interest in how things work, the business of a city is absolutely it's highly technical and very important. It's what allows people to live together in a community. And being involved with the police department and the sheriff's, fire department and the various planning department, the housing, all those sectors of what allow a city to be a city, the water treatment plants, the disposal of solid waste, all that stuff that we just literally take for granted. And in particular, the expense of, this relentless upkeep of a city as your own house, but a city's the same way. You have to keep up with the maintenance. And the things that we just take for granted that we don't see, the pipes underneath the ground, when you have to replace pipes, it's pretty pricey. So all those things came together. And again, selfishly, it was just a very, very interesting role to serve in.
Yeah, I understand we're replacing lots and lots of pipes right now to get our drinking water in control.
That's true. And around the nation, there's so many miles of lead-based pipe that there's no tolerance for lead at all, even in a minute amount. It damages the brains of developing infants and children. So replacing those lead-based pipes is just an essential thing that our country needs to do. And gradually, it's getting around to doing it. I might add that, the business of running a city, there's a great deal of technology, believe it or not, involved in that. This trenchless technology that came about 20 years ago or so, where they can actually replace, without digging down to where the pipe is, if there's a pipe in the ground, they can run a little robot through it with a cable, and they can expand that, blow that pipe up, and bring a bigger pipe to replace the old one without having to dig up. It's just remarkable, the technologies that are available these days.
Yeah, we're going to get into a lot of technology talk in this interview, I can tell. But first of all, what were the years that you actually served the city in an elected capacity?
Well, this would have been from 1996 through 2005.
Okay, so that predates my arrival by at least a decade. Would you say that the quality of life in Great Falls has been on a sort of a constant upgrade since that time? Or are there areas where you say that we could be doing better today?
Well, yes and yes. Great Falls was heavily dependent upon the smelter, the Anaconda Company smelter, for many, many years. The smelter with the Butte mining operations closed down, the copper mines down there closed down. Great Falls, of course, was the refinery for those copper products, and employed a huge sector of the labor force in Great Falls and Cascade County. When the smelter closed, Great Falls didn't shut down, but it really took an economic hit from all those jobs that just disappeared. So it's been in a recovery mode ever since then, but fortunately, Great Falls does have a diverse economy. We have some remarkable assets here. We've got Malmstrom Air Force Base, for example, And with the upgrade of the missile, the three missile bases in the United States to make these bases, the missile launching facilities, technologically up to date for the next 50 years, as they have been for the last 50 years, you know, all of us would prefer we don't have nuclear weapons, but other folks have them, so we have to have our own. So Malmstrom is a very important part of the national defense in that fashion. And the upgrade of these missiles will bring thousands of workers for about 5 years to both Great Falls and Lewistown, Montana. So we've got the base. We've got some very, very important agricultural production in this north central area of Montana with wheat, one of my favorites, of course. If you like beer, the barley crops of Fairfield are very important for those of us that do. New technologies there, the pulsed crops, peas, that sort of thing, up on the High Line. Cannabis for fiber, not for smoking, but for fiber. There's places growing a lot of cannabis here in Montana. So those new technologies are in the agricultural field as well.
Well, of course, now we have the cannabis for the smoking as well.
Well, that part's true too, but the bigger part of it is for the fiber of the cannabis, and you know, Montana has the old Plum Creek Mill up around Columbia Falls. They're using fiber from, you know, from wood fiber to create this oriented strand board that can build beams with resins and polymers that glue all that stuff together, that use the fiber in wheat and straw and wood and all kind of cannabis, and they can build beams that can build 100-story tall skyscrapers. So Montana has some pretty high tech going on all around the state, and Great Falls in particular does too.
And those are the kinds of things that wouldn't have been in production when you were mayor.
Those things were just starting, and so yes, ever since then the replacement again for the Anaconda Company, following these other things we're talking about, has really strengthened and created opportunities for Great Falls for the future. So I'm very bullish on the future of Great Falls and Cascade County.
As am I. And now I noticed you mentioned the upcoming silo replacement and upgrade project and the thousands of workers that will be coming to Great Falls as part of that project. Are you following the new planning director's attempt to organize a citywide participation to the update of the 2013 growth policy? And what do you say when people say, oh, those workers coming in, they're only going to be here temporarily. We shouldn't be planning for them to stay.
Well, yes, I have been following that a little bit, although, you know, I'm completely retired from city government, but I do keep an eye on things from afar. Brock Cherry, the planning director for Great Falls here, is, by my estimation, a very capable fellow. He's bringing together this sort of review process to take a look at the overall long-term plans for Great Falls. They have to be reviewed every 10 years or so. And it looks to me like he's doing a very good job, and the city commission is doing a very good job on robusting up membership for that committee and getting people from various sectors to put input in on it. And I think that that process needs to be very public, because it is, you know, this is the people's city after all. And, you know, affordable housing is a major issue. So I think that's one of the things they're going to have to put a lot of resource into. And one of the downsides is, you know, we have this NIMBYism in this country that everyone likes their house just as it is, and they don't want to buy the land next to them to, salvage some development they don't like on that land. And they don't want somebody else to develop that land, maybe with low-income housing. And yet, we need more housing. We need a robust housing stock of, you know, all varieties and shapes and sizes and costs. And one of the most important things a city can do is what's called infill, where they already have sewer and pipes in place for sewer and water and electric lines and all that sort of stuff. It's very expensive to keep expanding the city boundaries when you have available space right within the city that's already developed. And so we need to do a better job at allowing developments to occur, in neighborhoods that might not necessarily welcome that development there.
And I guess the city's footprint geographically was not quite as expanded 25, 20 years ago as it is now. There were more options for outward growth versus infill when you were mayor.
Well, that's true. But the other thing is the relentless push to build yet bigger and bigger homes outside of the city. So the development's going along, very, very high-end houses going on along the Missouri upstream from Great Falls. The new development that's right south of Malmstrom Air Force Base that's not part of the city. Those are, and people certainly are entitled to invest as they wish and where they wish to put their resources and their money. But, there's a lot of looking to take maximum advantage of great views. We've got some great views around Great Falls here. But the downside of that is it's kind of an inefficient way overall for infrastructure to occur.
Yeah, and it isn't just folks coming in for military upgrade purposes either. It seems like the last 5 years, 5 or 6 years that I've been a Great Falls resident, we've also seen a fairly large influx of new medical community participants as well.
Well, now you've hit a sweet spot for me. Yes, you're accurate in that observation. One of the things I looked forward to coming on your show here, Dave, so we could talk about this a little bit. I've been a longtime member and chairman of the board of McLaughlin Research Institute here in Great Falls. And McLaughlin is right near your neighborhood, right here, the College of Great Falls, MSU. There's a whole sector here with Benefis, with the college right here, with the Great Falls Clinic, with Touro Medical School, and with McLaughlin Research Institute that creates a core area for medical services and for medical research. And McLaughlin is a 70-year-old institution, started 70 years ago. It's been going all that time doing world-class cutting-edge research on all kinds of things, including discovering how tissue is rejected so that if someone needed a transplant of some kind of organ, this is the place that discovered why the body rejects someone else's organ going into your body. And they actually developed techniques for damping down your body's rejection of that organ so that you could make use of it. So they've been doing that kind of research for many, many years. Our research now is based on, we use the mouse model, but it's basically genetic research having to do with neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer's, dementias, mental health issues, addictions, and things like macular degeneration. And there is just some amazing work going on here. The McLaughlin Research Institute, we're on our fifth director in all these CEOs in all these 70 years. Dr. Renee Pera is an extraordinary scientist and an extraordinary leader. She and her faculty out at McLaughlin applied for a brand new NIH grant that is focused on rural areas. Most of the medical research previously had been going on, at Stanford University and Columbia University and University of Washington, places like that. This program was designed specifically for rural areas that just haven't had much research occurring in them. And we just were successful in receiving the first in the nation grant of this award, and it's for a total of more than $40 million. So it will the first batch will be about $14 million, and then it can be renewed successively two additional times for an additional $14 million each. That will help fund faculty going forward for the next 15 years on doing the research that we're talking about.
All right. So help me understand where the numbers here sort of marry up or compare with the military infusion in terms of likely size of the influx of new hires that we'd see, not just at McLaughlin, but let's say at Touro, Benefis, right, and the outer communities in this sort of core area you're talking about.
Well, in perspective, Malmstrom Air Force Base is not part of the city of Great Falls. It's not within the territorial boundaries of Great Falls. But we have a contract with them where their sewer and water and services are provided by the city of Great Falls. So the city itself, I think, is about 60,000 people. And Malmstrom, with the dependents and so forth out there, is probably an additional 5,000 or 6,000 people on base. Plus, a lot of people on base, as you know, live in housing in Great Falls. So that is a very large employer. That's the largest employer here, governmental employer. Benefis is the largest private employer. But when you take a look at the staff out at Malmstrom Air Force Base, you know, those are great jobs, and many of them career jobs. They aren't the best paying jobs in the world. So you have to compare what the average pay rate is for, you know, an airman versus a medical.
Now let's hit pause for a second, shall we?
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. You're the first. Okay, so help me put numbers on this. When we think about the potential growth of the medical community based on this grant, how does it kind of line up and compare with the influx of military personnel that we're likely to see over the next 5 to 10 years in the aggregate?
Dave, that comparison, it would be the grant that McLaughlin got, say $40 million, would be minuscule compared to the overall. I mean, this is several billion dollar upgrade among the three missile bases in the United States. So probably the upgrade in Great Falls out of Malmstrom here will be somewhat less than $1 billion, but that's a lot of infrastructure and contract. A lot of work will be done by contractors in this area. So all that construction work over the period of time that they're going to be doing this in Malmstrom, I think it's going to be like a 4 or 5 year term at each base where they're doing it, Minot and here and F.E. Warren and in Wyoming. So the McLaughlin bite of what we got would be minuscule compared to that. But you put it in context with McLaughlin in context with the new Touro Medical School, which is, they will have 125 students per class times 4 classes. That'll be 500 students here. It's a DO program, Doctor of Osteopathy. And many of those young people will end up staying in Montana. Touro is a wonderful program. They have a mission statement of serving rural areas. They also have a mission statement of serving Indian reservations. So providing doctors for all over Montana, and then all the faculty that will be necessary for teaching all those students is that's a lot of people. Among those people will be, we already are, our faculty at McLaughlin, the folks that teach our genetics programs and biochemistry and all those chemistry and that, all those kinds of courses. Our faculty at McLaughlin are already the faculty for Touro, teaching the students at Touro Medical School, which is one of the reasons that Touro was so successful and prompt in getting their licensing to open this school here. They already had a built-in faculty with McLaughlin. So doing work with Touro, doing work with Benefis, doing work with the Great Falls Clinic, on clinical trials and those types of things, it puts together a pod of activities in research and medicine and actually entrepreneurial type ventures, because a lot of the work that these high-end medical research facilities do has to do with things that eventually can be taken to patent and can be then used for creating medicines and successful treatments. And actually successful cures, not just treatments. We're to the point now, medically and genetically, where we're not talking about just treatments for many of these horrible diseases. We're talking about actual cures. Things like MS, for example, which I've had for many years. The ability now to, we can actually insert medicines in people with MS that will remyelinate, that is, restore the nerve transmission function. That's one of the problems of MS. It causes problems with your nerve transmission. There are techniques now to actually restore that nerve transmission. So that's just one example of the type of thing that is so promising down the road, and not too far down the road, because some of these things are happening right now. So
yeah, just last week, I believe, we had Dawn Sexton on the program talking about her experience as an MS warrior, as she calls it. And I'm sure that downstream, those remyelization, am I pronouncing it correct?
Yes.
Will actually be very beneficial to folks in Great Falls and around the world.
Well, by way of example, when I first came down with MS, 30 years ago, there were no treatments for MS. Not only no cures, there were no treatments. And I was on the first FDA experimental course of the first drug for treatment of MS. I'm still on that medicine 30 years later. But in that time frame of three decades, there are now, I think, 23 different FDA-approved drugs for treatment of MS. And that's what's happening is the technology is developing exponentially quickly to the point now where you fellows are well aware of this, using artificial intelligence to enhance the ability of computers to understand images that human eye can't pick up, but the computer artificial intelligence can pick up and notice that cell right there with that image of that corner of that cell indicates a particular kind of cancer. So you can diagnose way before you used to, so you can start treatments way before you used to. So the point of all that, Dave, is that this whole sector, all these cylinders firing together, support and enhance each other and create opportunity for, again, not just the research part, but for entrepreneurial things too.
So it sounds to me like, if I'm doing my math correctly on the back of this envelope you can't see here, the likelihood of Great Falls showing another 10-year period like we had from 2010 to 2020 on the census of growing by only 3% seems almost mathematically impossible between 2020 and 2030, given what we're seeing happening right now and in the next 5 years on the base and all of this influx and all of this explosion of potential entrepreneurialism. It just doesn't seem possible that we can plan for anything less than 5 to 10% growth in our population, does it?
I think you've put your finger on it. The flip side of all this is beware of what we wish for. Many people like things just as they are right now, thank you very much, and they would just soon not have a whole bunch of new people come in. So balance in all things. You know, people over time have complained about, geez, why isn't Great Falls more like Bozeman, or why isn't Great Falls more like Missoula? And you deal with the hand you're dealt, and you know we never have that decision was made almost 100 years ago when the state legislature decided to fund Montana State University and University of Montana and the towns they're in. Great Falls missed out on that opportunity, so we're kind of coming back in at the back end and filling some of that gap with, for example, McLaughlin Research and with the Touro Medical School here now. So I think I think the things that we wish for that maybe aren't possible in the near term for us should be offset against the things that we do have that many of us just kind of take for granted. And I'll give you an example. In the last 2 weeks, my wife and I had the opportunity to go out to Benton Lake right north of Great Falls. It's a 25-minute drive from where we sit right now. And with the opportunity to view 8,000 swans that were out there. I mean, just a miracle of nature, those critters.
Wow.
And then a couple of days ago, my wife and I were able to drive 75 miles to the Sawtooth Mountain at the mouth of Sun River, where we took some photos and watched for several hours over 1,000 elk spread underneath Sawtooth. Those kinds of opportunities that are right in our backyard, you know, floating the Missouri Breaks National Monument right south of us. We're halfway between Yellowstone and Glacier. There's the fishing in the Missouri upstream from us, the Little Belt Mountains. There's a plethora of really nice opportunities for recreation and lifestyles right here in Great Falls.
Well, what do you say to the people then that, and I'm sure you encounter them from time to time, maybe even back in your days as an elected official. But what do you say to people that come to you and in their minds they're equating this preservation act, right, of these natural, this natural splendor of our area with government overreach and takings of landowners' rights to do as they see fit with their properties?
Well, it's a balance in all things, but Montana is one-third public land. And it is the public's land. It's equally owned by someone from Delaware as it is from someone from Dillon. And those public lands are, as they say, are owned by all Americans, and all Americans have the right to use those lands. And so there's no taking of anything from anyone. That's some of the pushback I would give to that philosophy. It's just not true. And the opportunity for all Americans to use those lands that really are being kind of sidetracked by other groups that want to, you know, make use of them exclusively for their purpose, whether it's maybe grazing cows or drilling wells or ATV use, whatever it might be. And there's no taking of anything from anyone. It's owned by all Americans and always has been owned by all Americans.
It's a fascinating perspective. So since you brought up the notion of our elected officials in the state, what do you see as the most pressing needs that we could define here locally in Great Falls? And if you like, the larger country, larger America, but those that we as voters can influence through our choice of representatives this November, given that it's an election year. What's your advice to folks as far as the questions they should be asking those running for office today as opposed to 20 years ago?
Well, one word in particular comes to mind that I think we're in woefully short supply of in our American system anymore is the word civility. And the ability, no matter what election you're looking at, a local nonpartisan mayoral race or a judicial nonpartisan race for a district judge, say in Montana, or the Montana Supreme Court, or the legislature, or whatever it might be, the school board, the governor's office, the ability as a people to follow, you know, America has had ups and downs in its history of all sorts. We've not always gotten along well, famously, but the ability to sit down and hear what someone else is actually saying and ask yourself, gee, am I wrong in my thinking on this? That is a very important part of what democracy is about. And so we should, number one, go into any election cycle with that view, in my opinion, that no one has all the answers to everything and good ideas come from everywhere. You know, as a practicing lawyer, I did jury trials. And I will tell you, it's powerful medicine to watch how 12 people picked from random from the streets of whatever jurisdiction you're in, when they sit down and listen to evidence and hear the instructions from the judge on what that evidence means, how each one of them bring value to the overall decision. Legislative bodies do the same thing. You know, the ability to sit down in a legislative session or a city commission or a school board and hear each other out, and hear the public's comments. All those things mixed together should come up with a good result and a good answer. That's what democracy is about. And I am concerned that we are getting, just pushing each other to the other side of the table and not only disagreeing with the person, but disagreeing with them individually. You know, calling into question their character. And that's, to me, a bad result for democracy. We need to get back to a position where we can listen to each other.
It's kind of fractionalization and factionalization at the same time.
They're spot on.
It's fascinating because I asked Bill Bronson this very same question in my very second interview as Voices and Views V2.0 host, and he answered almost exactly the same way as you just did. You didn't confer with Bill on that answer, did you?
No, but I know Bill, and so not surprising. So.
Yeah.
But you know, the other thing, Dave, you'd asked about, I do want to shamelessly put a pitch in for your Voices and Views program. I think one of the missing aspects now of our democracy is the ability of, having an investigative journalism capacity. Where, the Great Falls Tribune used to be, without question, the best paper in the state of Montana. And Dave Murray, I have high regard for Dave. He does, with his limited one-person presence, he does a wonderful job. And Jen Rowell does a wonderful job. And I want to put a pitch in for you, too. This, public radio, public television, Those are kind of the remnants anymore of investigative journalism. You know, people that can actually go out and find an interesting story and follow up on it. And I think that's, we're in this world now of social media where the old saying, you're entitled to your You're entitled to your own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts. It's investigative journalism is a bar against people, you know, coming up with their own facts. The ability to ask a follow-up question.
Well, I think part of that is the financial model of social media, and you could also argue of the model that the journalism in America has, the corporate interests in that, and then the lack of corporate and financial models in public radio. This is a more of a, like the lands you were talking about, this radio station and all public radio exists as a public asset and doesn't have that vested profit motive that commercial organizations have.
Right, and depended on, you know, contributions to make it work. And it's, you know, so much of what's so-called news anymore is just really entertainment. It's not news at all. It's people telling you something that you already agree with. So it's so those are some tough issues. But you know, the flip side is that we've made it through tough times before as a nation, and I'm bullish on our future as a nation.
As long as we can find a way to talk to one another civilly and with humility around our own stances and opinions.
Well, and agree, you know, to not be shy about admitting a mistake. It's I will tell you one story myself. This is from my time as mayor. We were involved in those days on turned out to be a not a very good idea to create a public power plant using coal-fired energy in Great Falls here to replace hydropower that was coming under Mike Mansfield's tenure as a U.S. senator from Hungry Horse Reservoir for many years. And when that went away after 50 years, there was a movement by some co-ops in Montana here on the east side of the divide and the city of Great Falls to generate our own electricity. And we got sucked down that rabbit hole, and I will frankly admit that that was a very bad idea that the city commission agreed to do. I think ultimately the city of Great Falls lost over $10 million on that investment. And the reason several of us in the commission went into it was we had an engineering report that said this would be the first plant in the world that would actually sequester CO2, that this would become the standard for how coal could be cleanly used down the road. And this was a world-class engineering firm that had this opinion on the plant. Well, it was not true then, and it's not true now. They never have come up with a foolproof way to economically decarbonize CO2. And there's so many better techniques now, you know, with wind and solar and green energy kind of things that make it, even if they can do that with coal now down the road, and again, the technology's not even here yet, but even if they could do it, these other generation techniques are just far cheaper than burning coal and having all the downstream issues that result from coal.
And as another coincidence to note, just yesterday, according to the date of this recording anyway, was Earth Day, Earth Day Proclamation Day at the City Commission. We actually, as members of Citizens for Clean Energy and Golden Triangle Resource Council, the local Northern Plains Resource Yep. Council affiliate, we were just awarded a city proclamation by our new mayor, Corey Reeves, in honor of Earth Day. There were several whereas clauses there that pointed out exactly what you just mentioned. So I think we are starting to wake up, if I could say it, to the fruitlessness and the pointlessness of trying to clean extracted fuels and trying to turn our attention more and more to the renewable right. clean sources.
And David, it's also the issue I'm particularly trying to point out is that, you know, I will readily admit this was a mistake we made as a city commission, you know, back in 2000 or so. And so people that are elected to office need to you know, champion their victories, and they need to admit their mistakes. And I think that's something that Americans can do more of that more productively.
Yeah, well, it takes a certain degree of self-reflection reflection and ability to observe one's own behaviors and one's own decisions in order to do that.
And passage of time, you know, the answers become clearer with 20/20 hindsight that weren't known, you know, years before. So.
Can we call it 2024 hindsight?
Yeah, 2024 hindsight. Mm-hmm.
So I know that you've been pitching in on the front lines of the ongoing election cycle this year, and I guess our listeners are probably interested or curious to know, are you optimistic that we're preparing for calm seas and smooth sailing with our new election administrator here in Cascade County, or do you foresee more bumps in the road before things smooth out on the elections front?
Well, probably yes and yes, but I'm optimistic. I've in my retirement, I've taken on a number of volunteer gigs. One of my gigs is I've volunteered for training to be an election judge, and also to literally volunteer with the election office to help stuff envelopes down there for mailing ballots out for school elections and all kinds of stuff.
Are you actually busier now than you were when you were an elected official?
You know, there's a little word that's N-O that I never learned very well. But no, this is a great time of life. There's you know, it's the time where you can you own your clock. Your clock doesn't own you. So,
That's great.
Anyhow, through that experience, I have high confidence in Terry Thompson that she's doing a great job down there, and the election will be a solid election.
That's great. And you're talking about November now.
Yes.
Okay.
And the school election is coming up right now, too.
That's right. In fact, I think ballots go out within a day or two of this taping.
Correct.
We're coming towards the end of our time together in Voices and Views V2.0 here, but I wanted to ask you about one other important point, and it ties back into the notion of energy sources and the environment and the public lands we're trying to preserve for future generations. So our environment, including the animals that we share it with, the people and the animals, we're sensing that they're under some form of threat, and it's often difficult for us to quantify and identify that threat. But a band of kids recently forced the state of Montana to admit in open court that there is in fact a problem here, right? And that we have to start looking at the environmental impacts of new energy sources. And I just thought I would ask, what do you feel are the primary areas that our listeners here at KGPR should be paying attention to and directing their volunteer efforts towards if they also want to add their weight to this sort of ongoing tug of war in public policy?
Well, you're referring to the Held case, and that was a landmark case for the whole United States based on the Montana Constitution of a right to a clean and healthful environment. I believe it or not, was a college intern at the Montana Constitutional Convention in 1972. So I sat through all the debates, not as a voting member, but as a staffer, and remember that debate very well. Maynan Ellingson Robinson, a lawyer over in Missoula, is a close friend of mine, was a classmate of mine.
Arlene Reichert, too, I imagine.
And Arlene, Maynan was the youngest, and Arlene was among the oldest delegates there. But Maynan's the one that really came up with that provision in the Constitution. And lo and behold, 50 years later, it was granted by our court decision the same weight that it was adopted with by the delegates and by the voters of Montana. And lo and behold, those words have meaning. And so we need to take in the cumulative impact of analysis of every decision that goes on in this country in terms of putting CO2 in the air or sulfuric acid in the water runoffs from old coal mines. All those cumulative impacts are really, really important. And it needs to be analyzed, and it needs to be for our kids and grandkids. It needs to be taken into account. So I'm very optimistic because we adopted that. I'm less optimistic around the nation because other states probably don't have the same kind of Supreme Court that we have in Montana. We kind of take that for granted that those rights will be guaranteed to us as a people. But, you know, again, the flip side, I will close with one very good piece of news. There's a book out entitled Tenacious Beasts, and I would recommend your readers, that your listeners take a look at that. It's written by a professor from the University of Montana. He's a wildlife biology professor and, unusually, a professor of ethics.
And you can name him if you like.
And I can't remember the name right off the top of my head, okay. But just Tenacious Beasts. And it's a replay of the number of species on Earth that have doggone near winked out, like the American bison that got down to as few as maybe 600 bison. Sea otters that got down to as few as, several hundred sea otters. Species after species, he goes through an analysis of how they were almost extirpated from Earth, and the flexibility of those species in reestablishing their populations once it was identified that they were at risk of extinction, how they came roaring back over the last 100 years. And it really is a positive view of, some of the problems we have. So,
and our survivability of those problems.
Our adaptability and our survivability, exactly so. The environment, if given a chance, can recover from just horrible abuse.
And a quick Google search reveals the author to be Christopher J. Preston.
There you go, Preston, Dr. Preston, yes.
And the subtitle being Wildlife Recoveries That Change How We Think About Animals.
There you go. And also about ourselves. So
we being animals.
Yes.
Of course, mammals, right? I remember a famous line of George Carlin's, which is, those who say, save the earth, need to remember the earth itself doesn't need saving. The earth will be just fine no matter what we do. It'll continue to revolve around the sun for several millions of years. It's the inhabitants of the earth that need the saving, not the earth itself.
Right. The inhabitants, including our children and our grandchildren. We need to look longer than just one quarter out. That's one of the weaknesses of our species.
So after reading Tenacious Beasts, it sounds like you would advise folks to look into groups like Wild Montana, Citizens for Clean Energy, Golden Triangle Resource Council. Any other groups you'd care to plug as far as community involvement people could look for?
Oh, my gosh. Montana is a great place for opportunities like that. The Northern Plains Resource Council, you mentioned, the Montana Land Reliance, Nature Conservancy of Montana. Glacier Conservancy is the fundraising wing of Glacier Park. Yellowstone to Yukon Coalition, it's a wonderful region-wide, to preserve habitat corridors and that sort of stuff. American Prairie Reserve is a fascinating project out around. I'm a volunteer with that as well, around Fort Peck Reservoir. And that's also a great spot. People might think about going out to make use of some of their campgrounds out there. We've got over 800 bison now on that landscape out there. We're reintroducing genetically pure bison to the landscape of northern Montana. So there's a whole bunch of, fish, wildlife, and parks, volunteer opportunities for, teaching fishing, teaching hunting courses. A person can retire and become busier than they ever hoped to be by these volunteer opportunities.
Sounds like you're a walking example of that tenet. Well, Randy Gray, it's been a real pleasure having you in the studio, and I've run out of paper trying to mark down all the different things that you're involved with here. So I'm just going to summarize by saying it's really been great to have a former mayor and the head of such a prestigious institution as the McLaughlin Research Institute here in our studio, and I'm really hoping that that this broadcast of Voices and Views V2.0 gets heard by several people in Great Falls, either live over the air or on our podcast, which is found at kgpr.podbean.com. Randy, it's been a real pleasure having you, and I hope you'll return and continue some of this discussion in subsequent weeks, months, and years.
This has been very enjoyable. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
This is David Zaslav with Voices and Views V2.0 on KGPR-FM Radio Dial 89.9. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.